Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 5 of Writers Aloud. This week features the Bulgarian-born poet, memoirist and novelist Capka Kasabova, who speaks with me about exile, travel, the art of tango, and the experience of chronic longing. Capka Kasabova was born and educated in Bulgaria and emigrated to New Zealand just after the fall of the Berlin Wall. She's published multiple poetry collections, plus award-winning novels and travel essays. Her memoir, Street Without a Name, about growing up in Bulgaria, was shortlisted for the Prix Européen du Livre and the Dolman Travel Book Award. And her second memoir, 12 Minutes of Love, about her globe-trotting obsession with tango dancing, was shortlisted for the Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust Book Awards. Capka's lived in Scotland since 2004 and now makes her home in the Scottish Highlands near Inverness. We met up in her writing studio on a rainy autumn morning. Capka, you grew up speaking Bulgarian as your first language. You then went to a French language secondary school in Bulgaria. Then you became fluent in English in the UK and New Zealand. And during your tango dancing adventures, you added Spanish and presumably some German during your years in Berlin. Have I missed any languages?
No, I think that's quite enough to make me sound linguistically flaky.
Gosh, and here was me feeling very clever for speaking English and Australian. Some would say that the language you speak affects the very ways in which you perceive the world and think about the world. So what's it like as a writer to be holding so many different languages in your head and to write in a language that you didn't even begin to speak until you were nearly an adult?
That is a question that I came up against when I was in my first few years of speaking English, when I realized that a writing language is a completely different thing from a speaking language. And I think for me that has been the great challenge, rather than simply holding the languages in my head, which you never really do anyway. You know, I sort of tend to hold two languages. So French has sort of fallen by the wayside somewhere, not in terms of speaking, but in terms of using it at a higher level. So I think that the real kind of the painful transition for me was from writing in Bulgarian, because I was already a writer, an immature and very young writer in my late teens, but still I had been writing for a few years in Bulgarian, and to make that transition into English was the real challenge. And it happened very slowly over many, many years, and I think it's something that never ends. If you've grown up in another language with different lullabies, all the children's stories that I loved as a child were in Bulgarian. And while the content is the same in English, the sound, even of names, rings differently. That when you learn a language that isn't the one you were breastfed, you know, you have to go through a phase of being a child. And I think that's a very, very good thing.
Yes, perhaps that's the daunting thing for someone who's a writer in one language with learning another, is that it takes sort of a lot of yourself away if you can't express yourself.
Yes.
In an adult and vaguely coherent and fluent way.
And for me that happened just, I think, at the threshold, you know, for me having read it somewhere that your late teens or maybe 20 at the most is the threshold for switching languages for a writer. And I was 18 when that happened, and I thought, well, if Joseph Conrad did it at 19, so can I.
So you've said that, for example, a children's story, even if it's the same story, it's very different in one language than another. And certainly for me, one of the attractions of poetry is the fact that it foregrounds the music of the language. Sometimes people look blankly at you when you talk about the music of language. And I guess I would explain it by asking them to imagine two people behind a screen and one of them speaking Mandarin Chinese and the other speaking Russian. And even though you might not speak a word of either language, you can hear that they're not the same language. And that is the music of the language. And you sort of allude to that in Street Without a Name when you describe your then boyfriend Michael falling asleep on a train in Bulgaria, lulled by the rocking of the train and the music of a language he's tired of trying to decipher. Do you feel, through the languages that you've spoken, that some languages are more suited to poetry than others?
You know, I have wondered that, especially when coming across translations of poetry, which are notoriously difficult, as we know, mm-hmm. a lot gets lost in translation. I don't think, you know, that some languages are poetically superior than others. I think it's just like listening to different types of music mm-hmm. with different languages, for me anyway.
If you were asked to translate poetry, what would your approach be?
They do say that reading a poem in translation is like kissing a woman through a veil, you know, and that's probably true, or indeed kissing a man through a veil.
We can't have everything.
Yes. I have had a go at translating poetry from Bulgarian into English, and I think it's just trying to capture the texture of the language, the voice of the author, in terms of cadences, obviously, in poetry, but also in terms of mood and texture, you know, the smell of the poem, how to preserve it. And I think it's not too different with prose. I've translated a book of short stories called Circus Bulgaria by a real master of the short story, the author Diana Enef. And they were very short stories, just almost working on the poetry principle, where you can't throw anything away, you can't sift through the language, you have to preserve every single sentence, because he's a very economical writer.
Let's return for a minute to your secondary school in Sofia. In the first year there, they taught you French very intensively, and then for the remaining years, they actually taught in French. And the impression we get from your memoir, Street Without a Name, is that Soviet-era Bulgaria was tremendously inward-looking, you know, constantly emphasising Bulgarian history, Bulgarian culture, you know, the Deeds and Documents radio show every morning full of Bulgarian history, and sort of emphasising Bulgaria's place within the socialist bloc. So, given that for most citizens, getting off to Paris for a weekend was completely impossible, and also that French would have been a language of the corrupt and corrupting capitalist West, how did this actually fit in? It seems a bit incongruous to have a French language school in communist Bulgaria.
It does, doesn't it? I think it was just one of those lovely remnants. Those language schools were a remnant of a previous, more open era before totalitarianism clamped people down. And it was a miracle that those language schools survived, and they were indeed of a very, very high quality. You know, the graduates of those schools, English, French, Spanish, Italian language schools, usually came out speaking fluently. So a strange kind of oasis of Western decadence thrived in those schools. But what was really funny for me was that I spent 3 or 4 years at the French school in Sofia, having never been to France, of course. Then we emigrated to New Zealand, and 3 years into my New Zealand life, I got a scholarship to go to Tahiti. So I spent a month in Tahiti, and that was my first actual contact with Francophone culture. And yet the people in Tahiti thought I was French from the métropole, because my French was accentless, except it was a kind of fake French, because I'd never been to France or anywhere else. Those were the paradoxes of the Cold War.
It's interesting what you say about speaking fake French, sort of inhabiting it from the outside, because that very much seems what a novelist does, in a sense. You're inhabiting lives from the outside.
Yes, inhabiting a kind of parallel, a parallel dimension. I think in the case of speaking those languages from the other side of the Iron Curtain, as it were, was an imposed parallel world. But as you say, that fits in quite well with the self-imposed imaginary or imagined world of the writer. You know, sometimes I think that emigration, for all its heartache, all this moving around, has served me really well, and perhaps has been a kind of necessary thing for me as a writer, the outward expression of an inner disposition as a writer to always be an outsider. I think all writers are like that, even those who have, you know, always lived in the same place.
And in fact, both of your memoirs, both about Bulgaria and about your obsession with tango, have a very strong sense of somebody desperately looking for home or for a place to belong. I mean, have you found that all your travelling and that immersion in different languages and different cultures has changed your idea of what home is? Can a person who's become exiled from where they came from originally and become a citizen of the world, as you seem to be the epitome of, ever truly have a home again?
I don't know, you know, whether those phrases that we use now, citizen of the world, global soul is another very attractive phrase, whether they actually are just another way of saying lost soul. The Tango Odyssey, that particular search or obsession for a sense of belonging in tango has produced, I don't know, just a sense of actually home is not necessarily a real place. Home is not a place, it is a state of mind. Perhaps it's simply, now that I'm 40, maybe that's why I'm saying this, but perhaps it's simply a way of being with yourself, being in the world. Perhaps that is home. But to be slightly less abstract, I think when you leave your homeland and sort of try to make a new identity for yourself, that can be done in a number of ways, and I think I did it in the most fractious possible way, by rejecting where I came from. You know, I never want to go back to Bulgaria. You know, there was a kind of antagonism there. And I think, for me, the struggle has been to accommodate all these different selves manifested in through places. So now I feel less antagonistic. In fact, I feel that I'm embracing, you know, my origins more and more, but in new ways, not in a nostalgic, sentimental, looking back way necessarily, because I think nostalgia is very dangerous. And nostalgia, yes. Its post-communist equivalent is even more dangerous. And I think maybe that's a challenge for all of us, you know, to somehow come to terms with childhood, with what is lost, and what we tend to sentimentalize perhaps, or reject outright. Perhaps that's what home is about.
Well, speaking of outsiderness, in 12 Minutes of Love, your very pithy Kiwi friend James remarks to you, KK, you're an outsider everywhere. And I know, speaking for myself, I think I always felt like an outsider in Australia, despite the fact that that's where I'd grown up, which I think is probably more my own temperament than anything to do with Australia. But I think one of the reasons I really like living in rural Scotland is that because there's such a strong local identity and a long history and cultural history, I just definitively am an outsider here. You know, there's no doubt about it. So suddenly that sense of being an outsider can be grounded in something or pinned on something. You know, suddenly it's more rational and more interesting and somehow less lonely than it was when I was at the place where I was supposed to be at home. Have you experienced anything like that?
Yes, absolutely. I think you've just articulated that strange alienation, you know, a little bit like Camus' Outsider, the alienation of having the pressure of belonging because this is where you're from. I definitely felt growing up in Bulgaria, you know, even as a child, feeling I was born in the wrong place, I was living in the wrong place. But as you say, I think that's much more a matter of temperament. And perhaps that's the writer's temperament or the artist's temperament. And it's not a reflection on the place. I think you can feel an outsider anywhere.
It must be tremendously unsettling for people in the former Soviet bloc to have this sense that they are in the place that they came from, and yet the place that they came from, if they're our age, has changed so radically over the course of their lives, as must be the case for much older people as well, where they've seen sort of two enormous social changes sweeping through. Is there a sense that everybody in some ways is feeling like an outsider now?
Certainly in the Balkans, which is complicated in other ways too, mm-hmm. because it's the Balkans. I think there is a kind of collective disillusion and displacement, a kind of psychic displacement. I think the Cold War was a collective trauma, and I think it hasn't gone away. And the fact that in much of the former Soviet bloc, there is no such thing as truth and reconciliation. There is no public discussion of many of the things that went on. There are still secrets. That prolongs the trauma, I think.
Are you troubled by secrets? Is that one of the things that drives you to write, that sense of there being secrets and things that weren't talked about?
Definitely. Definitely. Isn't that why writers write? Because they have secrets?
So another diagnosis that you received from the very perspicacious James was that you had a case of what he called chronic longing. So we learned from your book that tango is a fairly ineffective remedy for longing. But what about writing? Was it driven by longing?
There's a lovely French word, dépaysement, away from your country, being decountried. And I think that is, again, going back to the being an outsider, that is the chronic longing. That is the kind of Ovidian exile, I think, if we want to be very grand, we can see at the root of writing. But I think for me, the chronic longing since childhood was somehow linked to places, wanting to be in some other place, you know, having a kind of geographical dimension to that longing. You know, the tango is the music of emigration, of uprootedness, which is why it attracts such people, I think, worldwide.
Complicated people, as you put it, yes. It doesn't seem to make them any less complicated by the sound of it.
No, it makes them more complicated. But like I was saying before, I think it's now becoming more and more of about internal states, to reach a certain state. That has become my longing as a writer, to reach a certain, I don't know, a moment in my writing or a certain experience where I know I've sort of, you know, I'm there. I'm at the heart of the thing. So it's become much more an inward journey towards experience rather than an outward journey towards places and action. And maybe that's just growing older.
And wiser, I hope, and wiser. You talk about a thing called tangasm in tango, which is a dance with a partner where you're just perfectly in harmony, and it sounds almost like a transcendent and very spiritual experience. And it made me wonder whether tango provides this fleeting but intense illusion of intimacy, but without any of the fraughtness of real intimacy, which has its terrible moments of failure and miscommunication. The boundedness of it is really interesting too, in the sense that you might dance with that person for your 12 minutes, but then the culture very much says, right, that's that. You might say thank you, go and sit down and have a drink to recover. But there is a sense that the rules of the game make it something that has to end, and you kind of know that going into it. I wonder if that is a kind of a safety net. It's a way of having those moments of intimacy but retaining freedom in some way.
Yeah, if you're wise enough to to follow those rules. And then you can really be in the spirit of tango, because mm-hmm. I think tango culture has a kind of philosophy of life, because that's how life is, isn't it? It's everything lasts for 12 minutes or its equivalent, and then it's over. Live with it.
It's a lesson in letting go, isn't it?
It is a lesson in letting go and a lesson in life, and I think it's a very salutary one, you know?
Like you, I think I spent a lot of years struggling with a sense of emptiness or loss or hunger, a sort of melancholy, and with that, a delusion that if I just looked hard enough and searched hard enough, something out there outside myself would come in and fill that up and make that emptiness go away. I think as I've gotten older, I've come to believe something different, which is that there is a sort of void. Perhaps it's an existential void. It's about mortality or something. But it can't be filled by anything that you can get from outside, whether it's a relationship or success in the world's terms or just possessions. And somehow that the thing you have to do is acknowledge that it's there and accept its company on your journey. You know, you have to move forward as though you yourself might feel it by producing things, by being creative. Am I kidding myself, do you think?
Well, I hope you're not. In tango, there is a feeling that people get, if they're lucky, a feeling of flow. You know, as you walk or dance and move within the music, you have this creative flow. And I think anything that we do in life which gives us a sense of creative flow makes us happy, and it puts us at the center of life, of experience. And what more can we ask for?
I'm so glad you said that, because if I have an addiction, it is creative flow. I'm really interested to hear that that was part of the experience of tango. So I can really understand now how a writer could get so drawn into that, because that experience of flow is transcendent, isn't it? You know, time disappears. It's the most joyful, playful, wonderful thing.
Yes, and that's why tango appeals to all sorts of people, because it makes an artist and a lover out of everyone. That's what tango does.
Towards the end of 12 Minutes of Love, you have the revelation that you don't need to dance to have what you call the soul of tango inside you. Instead, you say, you need hope, which is just another word for love. And when I read that, I thought, it's not the love that's very needy. It's not the love that's a hole to be filled by somebody else. It's the love that's about giving something back, about benevolence to the world, which is a kind of hope. It's a way of living hopefully. It's a way of living optimistically in the face of mortality and all the grimness. In a funny way, this sense of longing and wanting exile or wanting to be somewhere else, you know, it's quite a miserable experience. And yet I wonder if at the heart of it, there isn't a kind of a resolute optimism, which has just got a bit twisted, because in a sense, it is a belief in something better, that things can be good. And perhaps when you come to grips with the empty bit inside yourself and accept it and embrace it, then that can sort of turn into a natural optimism and an enjoyment of life and a moving forward more positively. Do you think there is a connection there?
Yes, and I think, you know, some of these things are simply phases of life. For me, miserableness accompanied my youth. And that was a kind of existential posture and learnt behaviour, and certainly reading Camus helped. And it can become entrenched, but I think maturity and experience and having adventures and being able to put the world in perspective teaches you that actually the most important lesson is joy and appreciation and I think that's what growing up is about. Perhaps that's what writing is about, because it is a perpetual gesture of hope, isn't it, writing?
So finally, what does a good day look like to you?
Writing without being interrupted, including self-interruptions. Self-interruptions are the worst.
Kepka, thank you very much for talking with us.
That was Kepka Kasabova in conversation with me, Kona McPhee. You can read more about Kepka on her website at www.kepka-kasabova.com. That's Kepka spelled K-A-P-K-A and Kasabova spelled K-A-S-S-A-B-O-V-A. And that concludes episode 5, which was recorded and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 6, we have the second part of Annie Caulfield and Emma Darwin's conversation about genre swapping. This time, Annie gives Emma the lowdown on writing radio drama. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.